Succession number 28639, Reel 3.
No, sorry. Jack Hewison, Reel 3. Sorry, Reel 3. Sorry, Jack, that's fine. Okay.
So, I was so upset, I used to lie there, just sobbing myself to sleep. And the chap lying next to me said, why don't you do something about it? So I said, well, what can I do about it? He says, come and see. Because he asked me what was the matter, and I told him what I did to witness. He says, good God, because he was a grown man. I was still a boy, this lad who was lying next to me. He said, I'm going to see my priest. I said, I'm not a Catholic. So I said, no, I couldn't do that. So that was left. So I went, he said, well, go and see your padre. So I went and saw both the naval and the army padre in the camp. And both of them told me the same thing. For God's sake, man, grow up, we're at war. He said, these things happen. Well, that didn't satisfy me. So in the end, I was lying there, and the same lad said to me, well, come and see my priest. I'm sure he'll do something for you. It's the best thing I ever did. I said, well, I'm not a Catholic, but I'll come. He said, he'll give you his blessings. She said, just tell him you're not a Catholic. So I went with him. And he had this little space inside this hut that he was allowed to use by the Japanese for his little communions and what have you. And I said, I'm not a Catholic, Father, but I said, it's all right to call you Father. He said, yes, that's the order of the day, he says. So he was very nice. He said, now, what's your problem, my son? So I told him my experience. He says, his first word, he put his hand on my head and he said, my God, son, he said, you've been to hell and back. He said, I feel so awful for you. He said, well, I'm going to tell you a story. He said, which I think will help you. He said, I sit down, it's going to take a little while. He took me around the stations of the cross. I'll never forget that. He turned every station of the cross, he told me what Jesus had put up with. And by the time he finished, I had recovered. And I thought, if I ever do anything else, I'm going to become a Catholic because they've saved my life, because all the atrocities I suffered from there on, I'm sure it was when I met Jesus Christ in that prison camp. That was quite fabulous, that was, really, for me. And I did become a Catholic in the end, as you'll find out later on. But from then on, I felt a bit better. It took me several days to get over it, but I kept thinking about the stations of the cross, what Jesus went through, and the blessings that he gave me. And that helped me. He gave me faith in myself. And it helped me because the first atrocities I had to suffer after that was, we were on the November, the following year, that would be 42, November 42.
Well, just...
I'd been up till then in the Shamshibu camp all the time.
I just wanted to... You were in Kowloon.
Yeah, in the Shamshibu camp.
And you were still in the same camp all that time?
All that time,
you
yes.
Weren't moved?
You weren't moved, no.
How quickly did the camp sort of organise itself? And
well, it never did organise itself, really, because of several reasons. Of people trying to escape. And each time they tried to escape, they were caught. And we couldn't understand why this was so. I don't know if I should tell you this or not, but it's up to you to decide afterwards.
Please do notice.
But there was one case where they dug not a tunnel, as you would call a tunnel, but one of the barbed wire fences was just near the coast of the harbour, the Hong Kong harbour. And a group of naval people organised by getting up to the fence when we were getting food. At this stage, they were still allowing the Chinese to come to this fence and hiding food over, because the food we were trying to survive on was just impossible to survive on. You were just getting a handful of rice a day, and that was it. There was nothing else going with it. And, of course, people were dying of beriberi and all sorts of diseases in there. And they were getting messages, so they managed to, this was the final one, they managed to plan this, to have a sandpan close by, where during this night they were going to go dig under the fence and get out. By the way, they had electrified the fence by this time. And to prove that it was electrified, they called a tenko, as they called them, a roll call. And during the roll call, they collected some dogs, one or two dogs, and to threw these dogs against the railings to prove to us they were electrified. And this is part of the brutality of the Japanese. So because of that, they dug this tunnel just underneath the fence. And they got out all right, but waiting for them on the other side was a gang of Japanese just waiting, and they were all just butchered in front of us. It was quite awful, just outside the camp. Now, this sent an inquiry, because they did have an escape committee by this time in the camp, and this escape committee were worried about this, and they found out after investigations, they stopped any further escapes from that point on. And they found out that a Major Boone, B-W-O-N, if you've ever heard of him, of the Middlesex Regiment, had gone over to the Japanese, and he'd actually been sitting on the escape committee. Now, he eventually finished up, because of what I've just told you, he was taken over by the Japanese, and they got accommodation from outside. And as far as I know, he was court-martialed afterwards, because these officers that were on the committee were determined to get him when they came out, and apparently he was court-martialed out of the regiment later on, the
Middlesex
regiment. Yeah, there were machine gunners, Middlesex regiment. So that was it. So that was one of my experiences during the months in Chamshipo camp. But then we came into 42.
I just wanted to get the idea of the sort of routine. What did you do in the day when you were in the camp?
Well, we used to organise all sorts of things. We used to have started off half an hour games of football against the various sections. Like the army, started off with the army and navy, but then half an hour became too much for us, because we were weakening all the time because of lack of nutrition, and it was just a case of 10 minutes or. Just handball games, anything to amuse us. There was card games, things like this, organised by the officers and the padres, of course, the Catholic padre and the two naval and army padres.
But it was only a military camp. There were no civilians.
It was no civilians, just military. We were in there all the time. And by this time, of course, as well into November, into 1942, you see, because Christmas Day 41 was when it surrendered. So in no time at all, we were into 42.
And you're all getting weaker, you're not...
I'm getting weaker all
the
time.
People are dying,
that's
I
right.
imagine.
Yes, that's right. Now, there's a book, I don't know if you'd be interested in this, there was a book written by an island, Leon Nolan, Nolan, N-O-L-A-N-D, L-I-A-M, Nolan, and it was called... The Small Man of Nanataki. Now, he was a Japanese interpreter who helped to save a lot of lives during that period we were in Chamshipo. And he actually did a period on This Is Your Life under Raymond Andrews. This Is Your Life was called the Helen somebody. It was a lady, a girl, anyway, that was on. But because of having her on, she told us about this Japanese interpreter who used to smuggle drugs into the prison camp, the Chamshipo camp, to help us out.
So he was actually Japanese?
Was Japanese. He was an interpreter there. He was a reverend, apparently, who had been educated in America and gone back after joining the church. Had gone back to Japan, but his Christian life in those days in Japan, it was almost non-existent. They were all undercover because of the Japanese government at the time. And eventually, of course, when the war was started, he had to stay there, and he was commandeered into the army. And because of his knowledge of English, he was made an interpreter. And his first posting was to Hong Kong in the Chamshipo camp. And he was there while I was there during that period.
Did you know him? Did you ever meet him?
No, but I did. I was aware of him. I was aware when some of the beatings I got for things I did that they didn't like, and I could tell that he didn't like the scenes of me getting beat over the head with a belt with a buckle on it, where it went round your head and eventually the buckle would tear your face, and it was just bloody awful. It was the way they treated it. Small things that irritated him, like, what are you doing near the fence? You're within 10 yards of the fence, or whatever the Japanese terminology was for that. And that would be a beating you would be at that. But every time we were beaten up, we were taken to the guardhouse, and this was when the sergeant would appear. And one guy who's dead now, he was caught pinching food. I remember it as if it was yesterday. And he was to be very badly beaten in a confined area, in a room. And because of the brutality that previous beatings had taken, this interpreter said to the commandant, "It's my turn. I've never done these beatings. I'll do it this time, if I may." And he said, "Yes, good training for you," he said. So he took this chap in. Now, I didn't know this until afterwards, because I found out from this chap afterwards how, why he got away with it. He said, "This small man in Nagasaki, I forget his name, his Japanese name, but it'll come to me later on." He said, he took me into this room, and he said, he whispered to me in English, he says, "Now, I'm going to beat," he said, "this cushion and this table like hell." And he said, "I'm going to hit you, but every time I hit you, I want to scream. And as I beat you more and more, I want you to scream and more and make as much noise as you can." And he did this. He said it was half an hour before, he says, the commandant banged on the door and said, "Release him." And he said, "I had to be dragged out," he says, "by," he said, "they let me lie there, and they ordered some of the other ex-POWs, POWs, to come in and collect what was left of me," he said. But he said, "I was dragged out and taken to the little hospital, so-called, we had in the camp, with the medics that we still had around." And he said, "I fully recovered because I was all right." He said, I'd created all sorts of tears in my face and my nails and that. He said, which were all recoverable. But he said, I was pretended to be unconscious. And he said, when they dragged me out. So that satisfied the commandant. And this guy, if he'd been caught doing that, he'd have been shot straight away, this Japanese. But this is all in this book, The Small Man of Nagasaki. Anyway, that was part of my experience in Shamshipur. Then it came an order that 1,812 of us was to be shipped to Japan. That was in September of 1942. I remember that, because my birthday was in the middle of September. And they lined the people up that were going, and they were the fittest of the people who were in there. The youngest, of course, the youngest of the element, mainly. Although there were some of the older ones that were fitter. And we were being taken to Japan. And we were to be told by this Japanese interpreter that came in, not the interpreter I just told you about. He was a chap called Nimori, N-I-M-O-R-I. I'll remember his name until I die, because he was an absolute sadist, he was. He gave us this little lecture saying, "You'll be taken to a beautiful country where you'll be treated well, providing you do what you're told." So in early November, we were taken on board the Lisbon Maru, Lisbon as in Portugal, Maru being Japanese for boat or ship. And it was a freighter, an 8,000-ton freighter, I believe. She had three holds, this ship, and we were taken out, and 50 of us, all naval ratings, were put in the forward hold. Down in the bottom, there was two sections in the hold, the upper and the lower part. We were but in the lower part of the hold. And as far as I know, it was the same in the other two holds. The naval people were all put in the forward hold, down in the bilges, as you might say. And the army and the RAF were in the hold immediately behind the bridge. And then in the after hold was the remnants. There were the medics and all sorts of odds and ends. They're all Hong Kong Volunteer Air Force people. We're all put in the after hold. And we set off. Now, we were allowed up on the upper deck because there was a temporary toilet put on the side of the ship, just a wooden thing that hung over the side. I'll never forget, it was a pleasure to go up the ladder. And by the way, I didn't tell you that on the upper hold, of each hold, there was Japanese soldiers returning to Japan after the invasion of Hong Kong. So there were the buggers that read those nurses, probably, were in this lot. and they were in the hall just above us. We had to go up through this hall to get to the toilet. And of course, as we went up, two of them came with us. Any two came with us to make sure we didn't dive overboard, as if they could have stopped us. But I'll never forget the first time and the only time I ever used this toilet. You just sat on a piece of wood with your bare bottom over the edge. And it was all right until the ship lurched and your bottom hit the sea, because the ship was rolling quite a bit. And by the way, I didn't have any seasickness during this, but I don't know whether it was because of the being petrified of the situation or not, but it didn't occur to me to be seasick. And the only time I used that toilet, because soon after that, we were told we were going to be battened down. And the naval officer in charge of us, a Lieutenant Pollock, I always remember his name, P-O-L-L, all O-C-K. He was in charge of the forward hold, the naval chap. He was told that we were battened down for our own safety, and we couldn't understand why we were being battened down, because nothing had happened. But apparently we'd been told by the escorting destroyer that there were submarines in the area, so we're being battened down just in case. And of course, the next morning, early hours of the morning, there was this thud. And we thought, my God, what's that? We must have hit something. Because although we had been told that there was somebody in the area, they hadn't told us this. This was what we found out afterwards. That's why we'd been battened down. Then there was another thud. Soon after that, a third one. But where we were lying, it was just the thuds. And slowly but surely, the ship started to lurch. And we were still battened down. And of course, there was silence in the hold. Everybody was just lying down, pitch darkness. All the electricity went out. The generators had obviously been gone on the ship. But we still didn't know what was going on in the forward hold. Eventually, this Pollock said, I'll go up and see if I can find out. So he went up and he was stopped at the first hatchet where the Japanese people were still on board. And this Japanese Nimori said, you are all right, we've been hit by torpedoes, but he said, we're keeping you battened down because we're being towed to shallower waters and there'll be a boat coming alongside to pick you up. But that was a load of lies, we found out later on. Eventually we had, of course, people were saying, shouting, let's get out of here. And someone was saying, the man down next to me wants a toilet. And they were just relieving themselves where they lay, and some of them had dysentery. So you can imagine every time the ship moved, it was just absolute appalling conditions. It was just unbelievable. The stench was so bad, people were vomiting all over the place. And there's still darkness. And I found myself lying beside two dead bodies, either side of me. I was the only one alive.
They died?
They both died.
In the night?
And just died by just the condition they were in, I suppose. This went on for hours. I have to think of the period right. We're still on the second day. The day after the torpedo. We were bombed. We were torpedoed during the night, and it was the next morning this was all happening. And there was shouts of, let's get out of here, let's try and break out. And of course Pollock was saying, for God's sake, don't. He said, we'll all drown if you do that. He said, because the Japanese are just in the hole above us. They will just machine gun us as we're trying to get out. But then we heard this noise of the Japanese, delight, and we thought they were shouting the usual calls, but we knew that they were excited about something. And apparently they were being taken off by the ship, and we thought, great, it'll be the same ship taking us off. So that calmed us down a bit. But they started to unleash the battening down of the second hold. But unknown to us at this period, as they were getting up on the upper deck, they battened it down at the top properly, not just by as pulling as they did on the bottom one. But we didn't know this at the time. But this calmed us down for several hours. We thought, oh, that's great. We're getting out. But after a while, hours went by, and by this time it would be getting into the afternoon. And the ship was still moving slightly, so slowly.
That's misting. Right.
And this was getting so bad that people were getting worried about it. There was silence above by this time. So Pollock went up. He said, I'm going upstairs, he says, to calm you, and I'll see if I can get in touch. So he went up, and the first thing he said was, there's nobody in the top hold. There's no battening down, so we're free to get out of here. But not yet, for God's sake, just stay where you are. So up he went, and he managed to reach the top, and of course he couldn't get any further. So he called out, he could speak a bit of Japanese, this Pollock, and the Mori came to him, this Japanese interpreter apparently, and said, don't worry, we're battened down for the same reason I told you earlier, we're in the process of towing you to shallower waters. A lot of bloody lies again. He says, as soon as we're in shallow waters, we'll lift the battening down and let you out. He says, well, why batten us down? He said, if the Japanese soldiers are off. He said, the Japanese are still on the upper deck. And he said, if you try to get out, they'll just machine gun you all until we get into shallow waters. So they believed this, Pollock, and down he came. And hours went by. About 2 hours later, further on, the people were getting really out of hand in the hold. They wanted to break out whether Pollock liked it or not. So, and his defense, he said, look, I'm going to send someone up and open a part of the battening down and let some fresh air in, because the stench was so awful. This was creating more trouble, really, than trying to get out and save our lives. So, he said to me, I was still near him, being a wireless operator. Oh, in the meantime, by the way, he said to me, you're the wireless operator. Can you get through to the previous hold by Moss on the bulkhead somehow and ask him what the condition's like? Well, a chap called Silverstone, who was a petty officer, wireless operator, me. I said, well, my petty officers here, the both of us will do it. So I called out if he could come to me in the darkness, and he managed to get to me, and I told him what we wanted to do. So we went to the bulkhead, to the next hold, and we sent Morse. I sent the first lot. And at first, no answer. So we kept sending the same message. What's the conditions like in your hold? Eventually they came back. At the moment, it's reasonably safe, but the water is pouring in. It won't last for much longer. So he said, we're going to abandon ship. That was the final message we got. So we thanked them very much and wished them luck, you know, in our short abbreviated messages that we could do as well as SOPs. And we reported back to Pollock. So Pollock says, right, he said, you go up with this knife. He produced this knife, God knows where he got it from. Go up and try and cut slits in the tarpaulin, because he had already been up there, he knew what it was like. He said, but there's slits in, he said, it's wooden planks and tarpaulin on the top. But you'll be able to cut slits. So up I went. And I'll never forget getting up near the top. And I managed to grab, I realised there were ropes as well as on top of the, so I managed to hold one of the ropes that was cut from the surface and underneath the wooden planks. So I managed to cut a slit in there, and that let some fresh air, and there was roars. When the fresh air roared in, by the time it roared downstairs, because it was so appalling downstairs, that the real sniff of some fresh air was enough. To cheers of delight. So I managed to carry on to get a bit, and I got against this rope, and I managed to cut through the rope, but then I was against a plank of wood, so I couldn't go any further. So I started to, the tarpaulin was quite light, by the way, I managed to tear some of it by hand, and while I was doing this voice came, and a hand came and grabbed mine. I thought, oh my God, it's a Japanese. But a Scottish voice said to me, you're all right, Jock. He said, we'll get you out. And it was a Japanese, Royal Scot. And there was, some of them had broken out the hole that we had been in touch with and had pushed what Japanese there was at the time overboard. And they pulled back all the battening down, and there was a surge to go. I tried to get down the ladder, by the way, at this time, to report to Pollock while the Royal Scots were getting this this battening down off the hold, entrance to the hold. And down below, when I was halfway down, by the way, when they were all coming up the ladder against Pollock's instructions to go up orderly, they were all pushing up. And I had no alternative but go by the wave. I couldn't just get down. I couldn't. There was only one ladder, and you either had to force people off the ladder or go down. So I just forced up with them. And on the way up, people were trying to climb over me. And it was awful. You got to a state where you either had to kick people off you or go back down in the hold. And you falling down in the hold, you could have killed yourself, really. Because although it was the upper part of the hold, it was still a long way down. And I can still see the faces of some of the people when I got near the top, and they were trying to get over me to get out, and I was just kicking them off me. And it was just survival of the fittest, really. It was quite frightening. So I managed to push them out and get out. But by the time I got out, the ship was so at a lurch that you couldn't stand on the upper deck. And this Royal Scot was still there with a young lieutenant, Royal Scots in charge. And suddenly there was a burst of fire, and it came from the bridge of the ship, which was still above the water level. And apparently some of the destroyers had got back onto the ship, sinking ship, to try and stop us getting out. And they got onto the bridge and were firing, while some of the Royal Scots got up onto the bridge and managed to throw them off. Don't know how they did it. But one of them, or two of them, still fell onto the bridge with their rifles, onto the deck rather, and they were lying on the upper deck firing at us, so I had to take shelter on the upper deck. The upper deck part of the hold was risen a bit on the upper deck, so you could get behind it a bit. So I lay there for a while the Scots and this captain lost his life, because he charged down, they got up and they ran down the sloping deck, which meant they could go faster, and they pushed the two Japanese that had still rifles off into the water. But the captain was shot, and he fell overboard, wounded. Whatever happened to him, I'll never know. But this other Royal Scot, which right up till he died, I was very friendly with after the war. He was a corporal. His name was, Thompson. I'll always remember. Jock Thompson, his name was. And I still kept in touch with him by letters and everything after the war. And he died only just last year, he did, poor devil. But he saved our lives, really, on that ship.
Because he got you out.
He got us out.
So they'd abandoned you, the Japanese had abandoned you.
We were in the water by then. And now the destroyer that was alongside was firing at us in the water. We didn't know at the time that it wasn't the naval. Because, as I'll find out later on, the Navy were very, very good to us. At least my experience with the Japanese Navy was very good. We found it after. It was the Japanese that had come off the Lisbon Maru were lying on the Japanese destroyer decks firing at the people in the water. But we could see in the distance islands. So those of us who could swim decided to swim as we could, get under the water when they were firing at us, and get to the island. And keeping an eye on the ship, because we knew that if we were close to the ship when it went down, we could get pulled down by the suction. Now, while this was happening, we kept looking back at the ship, and suddenly the bridge went below the water. And of course, as the water went into the funnel of the ship, there was an explosion. And I can still hear to this day, between the yells of cries for help, was also singing. I'll never forget this. Abide with me. And it was so loud, you could hear it in the water. That was people going down to meet their makers.
Inside the ship?
Inside the ship. You could hear it was a lovely sound mixed with the screaming. It was quite appalling, that. And, it was awful, that was. And I was still in the water. Well, eventually I managed to swim clear of the destroyer. The island, and by this time I was still with people in the water, and I'd caught up with my own OC, who was the lieutenant commander of the shore station, the wireless station I was on. He came up to me and said, "Well done, Sparks," and we always called each other Sparks, and he was swimming alongside me, but he had a dysentery on the ship I didn't know of, and he was dying. So he kept saying to me, you know my wife Meg, because she was on the island with us until she was evacuated in Hong Kong. And he said, if I don't make it, well, you get, she lives in Dundee, but he says, you'll get in touch with the Ministry of Defence, you'll get her address there, and tell her that I did my best to rejoin her. Well, he never did. But I kept to his word, as I'll tell you later. But he went under.
Jack Hewson Realth.